Welcome to the Capitol Press Room for Monday, May 4th. I'm Susan Arbetter with news of the arrest of six Baltimore police officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray. We invited Lauren Brooke Eisen to the show. Eisen is senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. We'll be speaking with her about what improvements to the criminal justice system could be taken up in New York. Also today, Dean Skelos, the leader of the New York State Senate, and his son were arrested on federal corruption charges. Hofstra's Larry Levy will join us with his analysis of the state Senate's future. Last week, the Supreme Court heard arguments on the issue of same-sex marriage. Attorney and legal scholar Danny Alter will boil it down for us. And Governor Cuomo has officially accepted the blueprint to end the AIDS epidemic in the state by 2020. It's all coming up on the Capitol Press Room. In Ferguson, Staten Island, and Baltimore, the circumstances may have been different, but the outcomes were the same. Black men dead at the hands of police. Here are a few questions that we have. Why is this issue only now coming into focus when African-American families have talked about it for years? And will grand jury reforms like the one being considered in New York help ease tensions? We're joined now by Lauren Brooke Eisen, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, where she focuses on improving the criminal justice process through legal reforms. Lauren Brooke, welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thank you for having me on this morning.
So before we start, I just wanted to mention that another police officer was shot over the weekend in Queens and recognized throughout this conversation that police have an enormously difficult job to do. That being said, unarmed black men are dying at the hands of police agencies all over the country. Lauren Brooke, are these deaths the result of racism, fear, mass incarceration, all of the above, what?
Well, I think what we're seeing is historically reduced crime rates. So since the 1990s, incarceration has doubled and our crime rates have dramatically dropped. And this is across the country. And what we're starting to see is a bipartisan opening. And a lot of people are talking about criminal justice reform. So there's a space now to talk about what is happening in urban cities across the country. And I think that all of this is really tied to this larger problem of the overgrowth of the criminal justice system. So you've seen these, some of these have been shootings, and you've seen a lot of this unrest between the police and the communities because of what many people see as biased policing. And that really at the heart of that issue is the interplay between race, class, and economics. And we're seeing this play out in a lot of urban environments where poverty and especially poor African Americans they're really seeing the brunt of a lot of this biased policing.
So your answer to the question then, why are we now as a nation coming to grips with something that black families have been talking about with their kids for decades, is that there is a space now, a political space, where we can perhaps find an answer?
I think that's part of it. I think that we have seen, Ferguson happened, and then Staten Island, and then Brooklyn, and, Baltimore, and we continue to see this pattern. There's a lot that's happening right now. The president issued an executive order, and the 21st Century Task Force on Policing has been meeting, and they've issued an interim report for best practices for police officers to improve their practices across the nation. We've seen a lot of this divisiveness between the police and the community. So we're seeing the politics makes it possible to talk about this, and we're seeing a lot of communities finally saying, well, enough is enough, and we need solutions. We need not only grand jury reform, but we need real reforms that go to the heart of, a lot of these problems. Some of this is improving police practices. Some of this is, really increasing job access and improving the situation of a lot of our urban communities.
So I was listening to Morning Edition last week, and I heard several Baltimore residents that were interviewed about Freddie Gray. Some were white, some were African-American, and all of them agreed that it wasn't a racial thing. It was a class thing. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that goes through this interplay between race and class. And if you look at Baltimore as an example, one third of Maryland residents serving time in state prison are from Baltimore. There was an article in the New York Times just this morning pointing out that among the nation's 100 largest counties, the one where children face the worst odds of escaping poverty is Baltimore. And so I think class and economics really is at the heart of this issue, and we have to improve the opportunities for those who are living in our urban cities who may not have access to education and jobs and, you know, even, you know, proper health care. And that really is at the heart of a lot of what you're seeing in Baltimore and across the country. And, you know, all of these issues, they're interwoven, and you're really starting to see the connection between mass incarceration and racial disparities and poverty. And it's really, I think, just bubbling up at this point.
And it is a cycle, right? I mean, we have to address the fact that prison and mass incarceration has become a part of the cycle of poverty in some of these neighborhoods.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about 2.7 million children who have parents behind bars. Many of those are poor, indigent families. Mass incarceration has contributed significantly to the poverty rate in this country. Some research indicates as much as 20%. And you also have significant racial disparities born out of these policies. If trends continue, 1 in 3 black men born today can expect to spend time behind bars during their lifetime. We really have real problems in this country when it comes to race and poverty, and we need to start thinking about all of these issues connected.
A lot of people thought that diversity on the police force was one of the answers, but in Baltimore, 3 of the 6 police who were indicted were black. And much of the people who lead that community are African American. So what does it not matter that there are black people on police forces?
There is a lot of research indicating that improving diversity in policing will have positive impacts, but you need to do more. Police officers, they need training about inherent bias, right? Inherent bias is something that every American has.
No matter what color you are.
Yes, and it's very important that police officers receive inherent bias training, that prosecutors receive that training, that judges receive that training. It's important that we all talk about it, that it's part of the national conversation. And that is what's happening now. I mean, we've seen political leaders on the left and the right coming forth and putting together their ideas for how to reduce mass incarceration in this country. And people are starting to talk about the racial disparities that exist. And I think a lot more needs to be done. Baltimore is an interesting, microcosm of what's happening across the country. And in Baltimore, it's particularly interesting because you do have an African-American prosecutor who, bypassed the grand jury process and indicted, she's charging these officers.
Were you surprised at how fast that all happened?
I think a lot of people were surprised at how quickly that happened. However, this is a prosecutor who lives in Baltimore, who has connections to the community, and she saw what happened in Ferguson, and she saw what happened in Staten Island, and, learning from, some of the problems that prosecutors had in those counties seeking an indictment, it did seem quick to a lot of people, but at the same time, it's almost not surprising because she felt that she had probable cause to seek charges against these individuals.
And so she just acted, sure.
Yes.
So there are these reforms currently sort of in the ether here in Albany. One of them is grand jury reform. Another is raising the age of criminal responsibility for young people. If these issues are passed, will it help stem the tide of mass incarceration?
I think every step that our cities, our counties, our states, the federal government makes towards improving the criminal justice system, reducing racial disparities, reducing the number of young people who come into this system, I think every step is important. But we're talking about mass incarceration at such a large scale. 2.3 million people are incarcerated in this country. We have significant work to do, but a lot of the hard work is being done in the state houses, and the reforms that New York is that New York right now has the potential to enact are significant, and this raise the age legislation would significantly impact the number of juveniles who are treated as adults in the criminal justice system, and so they're all steps. But there really is a lot of work to be done, and you're seeing that in these protests in city after city.
What else could New York consider doing?
Well, New York could, New York has done some significant work already. But what we're starting to see in terms of policing, if you look at Washington, D.C., for example, Washington, D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier has really switched from this focus on zero tolerance and hotspot policing, and she's focusing on crime prevention and community policing and really improving the relationships between the community and the police. We are starting to see a lot of states, and New York is doing that already, but we're seeing a lot of states really investing in alternatives to incarceration. So investing in not only changing the statutes so that less people so that it's possible for less people to be sentenced to longer sentences, especially for low-level crimes. But we really do need to invest in the drug treatment programming and the mental health programming, really in order to stem the tide of who's entering our prison.
So part of it is investing in the social safety net?
Absolutely. And New York City is starting to do that. The city is going to be rolling out these, drop-off centers so that police officers can, bring someone who's arrested maybe for loitering or who may have mental health problems to these drop-off centers, not necessarily into central booking. So we are starting to see that, but we just need to do a lot more work in terms of our social infrastructure in this country. We need a lot more, significant increases in the amount of funding that we can use to support alternatives to incarceration.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Lauren Brooke Eisen is the senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, which she focuses on improving the criminal justice process through legal reforms. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
The top-ranking Republican in the state, Dean Skelos, and his son have been arrested on charges of soliciting bribes, extortion, and conspiracy. What does this mean for the rest of the legislative session, and who will take over for Dean Skelos as head of the Republican conference? Former award-winning journalist at Newsday, Larry Levy, who's currently the executive dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra, joins us with analysis. Welcome back, Larry.
Thanks for having me back.
Sort of a pall over Albany yet again.
Yeah, and especially Long Island, from where I am talking to you. I actually live in Dean Skelos' home village, and I can tell you that this is a body blow, not just to Rockville Center, but to all of Long Island.
Well, yeah, what's at stake for Long Island here, especially in terms of the choosing of the person who, if Skelos steps down from his leadership position like Sheldon Silver did after his arrest, who would be at, vying for the top spot, and why is it important for Long Island that that person come from Long Island?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that the leader, whether it's an assembly leader, a Senate leader, or a congressional leader, is going to show some love for his or her home district and home state. There have been plenty of anecdotal evidence over the years and probably some studies, I haven't seen one recently, that shows that the home state of the leaders tend to do much better, and I'm sure it's no different when it comes to the state of New York. Skelos has managed to become very popular with most of his members, most of the Republicans, by being seen as a pretty fair broker, as someone who spreads whatever patronage they have, whatever fiscal largesse that needs to go home. We used to call it the bacon, the pork.
Yep.
That people aren't grumbling as much as, say, they were during the tenure of another Long Islander, Ralph Marino.
It's been reported that both John DeFrancisco, who is from upstate New York, And Kathy Young's name has been mentioned as well. She's another senator from upstate. And John Flanagan, who's from Long Island, are vying for this spot. And I'm wondering if you can help us determine what the different priorities are for upstate and downstate. Or is this all about who can bring home the bacon?
I don't think it's entirely about who can bring home the bacon, although that's certainly a big, big part of it. You know, in New York, there are a lot of differences, wars that are fought. You know, and most of them, most of the interesting ones are not necessarily Republican and Democrat.
Right.
You have city suburb, you have upstate, downstate, you have conservative and not conservative. And within the Republican Party, you have upstate, downstate, which tends to play out more along the lines of the conservative versus the not-so-conservative. And in a sense, it's almost a microcosm of the war that you may see nationally with the Republican Party in this presidential cycle. Because Long Island Republicans have survived quite well, even with the changing demographics that have brought more Democrats to Long Island than Republicans, something that when I started out as a political reporter and it was 3-1 Republican back in the 70s, you know, this seems like an impossibility, but there are more Democrats on Long Island. So Republicans have had to practice what I call purple politics. You know, it's a little red, a little blue, and it ends up being purple. They tend to be, on average, moderates, although they, of course, can take some very conservative positions. And upstaters are very frustrated by this. Long Island Republicans, despite how they may vote, tend not to be great gun supporters. They do like to spend a lot of money on schools and on health, which is more than two-thirds of the state budget. There are differences on some other ideological and hot-button issues, and there are upstaters who are very frustrated.
Could the Senate Democrats take a chance on a coup, or is that what the IDC was there to prevent?
Well, that's a really good question. I have not talked to Jeff Klein in the last few days, and so I don't know what's going on in his head. But, you know, clearly, you know, there's a math game here, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Republicans have, I think, 33 members of their party in the Senate, plus Simcha Felder. Libous, who would have been the successor, is recuperating and unable to travel from Florida. Plus, of course, he's facing, legal problems of his own. So that takes one vote away. If the Democrats wanted to pull a coup, if they wanted to take over, they do have the numbers, but the independent Democrats, you know, may have burned some bridges, and they see their best play for now to stick with the Republicans and see what they can get from it.
How do you think this is going to affect the rest of the legislative session? I mean, should we just go home now?
Well, you know, there's a feeling that that's the case, but, you know, there's stuff on the table that needs to get done. And I'm not just talking from a goody two-shoe civics 101, we have to get the people's business done. These members are elected by their home districts. And there are people in those districts who, frankly, don't care about Shelley Silver and don't care about Dean Skelos and all the other stuff that dominates the conversation in the hallways of Albany. They want to see stuff get done. And that's going to apply a lot of ground up pressure for the session to continue. There are, especially once the leadership issue is settled.
Right. And some of those include things that really do have hard and fast end dates, like rent regulation, for example. Also, they want to amend APPR, the teacher evaluations. Mayoral control is another issue. Is there a possibility,
Well, there's more, and there's more. And if you want to get into the bacon area, there is the whole, there are pots of money that were allocated to the, I don't know if they did it specifically to the houses, but, I mean, everybody knows how the game is played, that the Senate gets a certain amount of money for probably economic development projects and other things that people care about back in their districts. The Assembly, of course, gets it. The governor has a share. You know, this stuff may yet still have to be settled during session. And, of course, then there's the whole Common Core stuff that's still bubbling up.
Absolutely. Interestingly, Senator Flanagan, who chairs the Education Committee, introduced a piece of legislation to sort of delay, give schools a little bit more time to get their APPR evaluation systems in the can. Over the weekend, on Saturday, this bill was printed. I thought that was an interesting bit of timing. How should the governor respond to this, if at all?
I don't know. You know, I've been more focused. Are you talking about to the whole leadership thing? Because there are some people who believe that it is in Andrew Cuomo's best interest to work with the Long Island delegation, the 9 senators.
Oh, why is that?
Well, because he had a good relationship with Gelos. Cuomo has been pursuing, on average, a moderate course. He annoys some Assembly Democrats, and he obviously annoys a lot of conservative Republicans. And he's had a good working relationship, you know, both with, you know, the purple Long Island Republicans and the purple independent Democrats. I mean, most of those folks really reflect a suburban sensibility that the Long Island senators do, and that is a moderate, middle-of-the-road, independent sort of politics.
Last question, and we have about 20 seconds, but you've been covering Albany for a long, long time. Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, and nobody's seen anything like this. I mean, to see two leaders go down within months of each other, and I shouldn't say go down because Skello still hasn't left office, but to see this kind of political turmoil involving people of this profile is unprecedented.
Larry Levy, Executive Dean of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra. Yet, thank you again. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So last year, a U.S. District Court struck down Kentucky's same-sex marriage ban. That ban prompted an appeal heard by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. Joining us to untangle the legal arguments the justices heard is Daniel Alter, an adjunct professor and fellow at NYU Law School, who has litigated many equal protection and First Amendment cases in his legal career. He was recently chief counsel at the New York State Department of Financial Services and was on the shortlist for the New York State Court of Appeals. Danny, welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is the name of this case, and how big of a deal is it for advocates of gay marriage?
Well, the lead case is named Obergefell versus Hodges. And I say the lead case because just procedurally, the court picks the first case of several that deal with the same issue to cite. And there are cases that have come up from Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, and Kentucky, which all deal with bans on marriage between people of the same sex.
So how big of a deal is this?
It's a very big deal. In terms of a civil rights decision, it certainly will be one of the most significant ones that I believe that the Supreme Court will make, certainly in the next 50 years, and will have a tremendous impact both on individuals throughout the country as well as the status of the court itself.
My understanding, my layperson understanding of what the justices have to decide is that they're looking at two things, whether a gay marriage ban violates the 14th Amendment and whether a state has to recognize the legal same-sex marriages performed in other states. Is that about right?
Your understanding is exactly right.
Thank you, New York Times. So tell us about the arguments on each side.
Well, the arguments on both sides really start off with a major argument about definition. And obviously, each side has a very different definition of marriage. Those who argue in support of the right of individuals of the same sex to marry define marriage as a state institution that recognizes, dignifies, and supports a profound and intimate bond between two people who love and care for each other over the course of their lives together. And based upon that definition, the parties have argued that they are entitled to marry under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And I'm happy to get back to that in a moment and kind of fill out what that means.
Sure.
The definition on the other side, those who would support a ban on people of the same sex marrying, it is really quite interesting for what appears to be a very, very narrow view of marriage. I think most people today would see this as a narrow view of marriage. And what those folks argue is that marriage is a state institution that has absolutely nothing to do with dignity between individuals. That marriage is an institution which is intended to forever, now I'm quoting from the argument transcript before the Supreme Court. Marriage is an institution, quote, to forever link children with their biological mom and dad when that's possible. So in their view, the fundamental legal core of marriage is to be sure that biological parents stick with their biological children. And they take it a step farther. They say if you change that definition, if you go with the definition being put forward by the other side, which emphasizes marriage being an important institution between two loving adults, what you essentially do is you you change the focus from children to adults. And once you change the focus from children to adults, you weaken the marriage bond, that it's more likely that individual adults who are really only thinking about themselves won't stick together, and that the familiar institution of marriage between opposite sex people will suffer accordingly.
Doesn't that only speak to marriages in which the two parties are of age to have babies? What about, you know, older people or second marriages or, you know, people who don't have children?
Well, that was a point that was argued for a great deal of time before the Supreme Court during the arguments last week. And the answer that the states put forward who wish to support the ban is simply this, that we don't have to get it perfect. We don't have to have a rule that matches every situation. All we need is to put forward what's known in the law as a rational basis, that is, something that is a logical argument that justifies the ban. And it may leave some people out, and it may include too many people. But if it's a logical argument, in their view, that's enough to sustain the ban against folks of the same sex marrying. Now, this is where the legal issues come into play. The people who seek marriage equality say, first of all, the way they define marriage between two adults who wish to engage in a profound, intimate relationship and support one another is a right that is a fundamental liberty right under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment guarantees individuals due process of law and the right to equal protection of the law.
What does that mean, equal protection of the law?
Equal protection of the law means pretty much what it says, which is if there is a law that treats people, well, I should back up a second, laws should treat like people alike. And the rub is how you define what like people are. So if you're going to treat certain people differently from other people, you have to have a justification for doing it. Well, the people who are arguing in favor of marriage equality say, we're all adults. We're all loving individuals who want to engage in perhaps the most important relationship that a human being can have in life. Whether we're heterosexual, whether we're homosexual, we all have that desire. So we should be treated alike. And the folks who are supporting the ban say, well, no, marriage is by definition about a relationship between men and women. So you're not treating like people differently. And that's why I say a good part of this issue is wrapped up in diverging definitions.
Sure. Sometimes you can tell a lot by what the justices are asking each of the attorneys. And at one point, I read in the Times that the Chief Justice suggested that, quote, the truly extraordinary pace of social change should perhaps continue on its own without some sort of interference from the court, I think, is what he was saying, that people want to vote on things rather than have them imposed on them by the courts. But the Solicitor General said that by abdicating any sort of ruling, the court would keep the status quo and would say, quote, the demeaning second-class status that gay and lesbian couples now inhabit in states that do not provide for marriage is consistent with the equal protection of the laws. That's not a wait and see. That's a validation. That's pretty powerful.
It's a very powerful statement because it's recognizing, at least from the view of those who want marriage equality, that the present state of affairs is a state of, you know, affirmative, positive discrimination. So if the courts just back out of it and let things roll on the way they are, and many people have drawn the comparison to our dark history of segregation, the courts didn't interfere and say, no, this is not consistent with the principles that are embedded in our Constitution, and we will not permit this discrimination to go forward. Justice Kagan had a very pointed response to that very argument, and she reminded the attorney for the state that we don't live in an absolute democracy. The United States is a constitutional democracy, which of course means that we have a constitution that sets out certain guidelines and rules, and some of those are limitations on what the majority can do to the minority in our society. And what those who are arguing for marriage equality are saying is that the equality principle in the 14th Amendment, the liberty principle in the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, are just those limitations on the vote. You can't simply vote by a raise of hands. You have to determine whether the outcome is going to violate one of the fundamental principles that governs our society. So it is appropriate for the courts to step in and assure that those in the minority are benefited equally from those protections.
So what else can we glean from the questions that the justices asked?
Well, it was a smorgasbord of questions, and it was very, very interesting. You know, it lines up according to what I think most people would see the divisions on the court to be. For example, Justice Scalia argued that there is no precedent in history that he can point to that would support extending marriage to include members of the same sex. Justice Alito took a walk down the slippery slope and said, well, if we allow this today, what if two men and two women came together in front of the county clerk and said, all four of us want to get married?
Hmm.
Justice Kennedy is, I think, by everyone considered to be the key vote on this, as he has been the key vote on many, many gay and lesbian rights cases in the past 10 years. And he made two sorts of arguments. To start off, he talked about the millennia of time, the ages that has only recognized opposite-sex marriage. And he was uncomfortable with the court coming in and saying, well, people have gotten it wrong for thousands of years. That got some people a little nervous, I think, on the side that were seeking marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
But then he quickly came in and said that and rejected the state's argument and said, no. Marriage is quintessentially a status of dignity endowed by the state. So he was very much leaning toward that kind of equality argument that was being put before the court. So was Justice Sotomayor. Chief Justice Roberts came in and threw a little twist into the whole argument and said, you know, maybe we don't have to get to the issue of sexual orientation in this case. Maybe we can just see this as a flat-out sex discrimination case. Jill loves Tom, and Joe loves Tom. Jill can marry Tom because she's a woman, and Joe can't marry Tom because he's a man. That's based on their gender. And that, I think many people are wondering whether it's an attempt to rule in favor of marriage equality without extending the legal theories that would broaden LGBT rights across the board.
So that could be concerning for people who want to the court to say, you know, these bans are not legal.
I think those who were seeking to overturn these bans would welcome a sex discrimination rationale as well, because it gets you there. But I do think people are hoping to win on a much broader theory of equality or liberty. if I could just add one set of points raised by Justice Ginsburg was perhaps the most interesting and direct response to this whole argument that for thousands of years there has never been anything like marriage between same-sex adults, so we shouldn't move in that direction. And what Justice Ginsburg said is, look, marriage today isn't like it was hundreds of years ago in this country or thousands of years ago across the world. She is a noted scholar of sex discrimination, and she, when she practiced, had a great, great series of victories on behalf of women's rights. And what she pointed out was that marriage was an institution by which the state promoted the domination of women by men. When people married, a woman lost her own identity. She became the property of her husband. She had no independent right to make legal decisions. All of these things showed that the nature of marriage years ago was one of subordination. And she said, over time, this court, the Supreme Court, has struck down those rules one by one and fundamentally changed the nature of marriage.
We are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for your insights into this case. And I'm hoping that you'll come back when we do hear that they've made a ruling.
It would be my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Daniel Alter is an adjunct professor and fellow at NYU Law School. He was formerly the chief counsel at the Department of Financial Services and is on the short list for the New York State Court of Appeals. The state is looking to reduce new HIV infections to about 750 a year. Back in 1983, this would have sounded like science fiction, but not anymore. Currently, the infection rate in New York is about 3,000 a year. But with a blueprint to end AIDS in New York, the state is looking to curb infections to sub-epidemic levels by 2020. HousingWorks founding president and CEO spearheaded the blueprint. Charlie King joins us with more. Welcome back, Charlie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do you know how many New Yorkers have died of AIDS since it was first identified?
About 150,000, about as many as are currently living with the virus.
So this blueprint and the interest of the Cuomo administration must have struck you as something phenomenal.
Absolutely. I have to give credit to the governor for making the announcement last June, committing New York State to be the first jurisdiction in the United States to end the epidemic. I think it was incredibly courageous of him to take that stand and to now have a roadmap for how we're going to do that is simply amazing. And essentially, I can't wait to help get the roadmap put in place.
Well, let's talk about this roadmap or blueprint, as some people are calling it. In order to bring down the infection rate of HIV, what does New York have to do? And does this blueprint provide the resources to do it?
So the task force was not charged with coming up with either a budget or sources of funds. But I am confident that the resources are there to fully implement the blueprint, and I'm happy to talk about that in detail, though it's a little bit complex. The core elements of the blueprint essentially are implementation of the three prongs that the governor articulated with his first announcement, identifying everyone who's HIV positive and unaware of their status and getting those people into care, ensuring that people who are aware that they are HIV positive are in care and are completely virally suppressed, which means that they cannot transmit the virus to anyone else, as well as contributing to their own ability to live healthy lives. And the third element is scaling up pre-exposure prophylaxis and non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis for people who are at highest risk of HIV.
Go ahead.
Well, if we can adequately accomplish all of those three steps, we've basically cut the virus off such that it really can't be effectively transmitted in New York anymore. And that's the real goal of this effort. frankly, we think there's some other steps that the governor can take, and we spelled them out in the blueprint that would get us down to even much lower than 750 new infections, something closer to zero new infections.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a quick break, Charlie, but we'll be right back. You're listening to the Capitol Press Room. My guest is Charlie King of Housing Works, and we're talking about the blueprint to eradicate AIDS by 2020. I wanted to ask you about the three-pronged approach that you detailed for us before. It seems to me that if there are, you know, what, 20,000 people walking around who don't know that they have HIV, that they're living with HIV, how are you going to get them to come in for a test and acknowledge that they have the disease and get suppressed?
So there's actually two major components to testing those who are unaware of their status. The first is we passed a law a while back requiring that every provider offer the test to every single person coming into primary care, to emergency rooms and inpatient admission, but that hasn't been effectively enforced. And we really need to do that because many, many people have contact with the system who need to be offered the test but haven't been. The second is more strategic targeted testing efforts that are aimed at cohorts of people who are most likely to be infected with HIV. And those actually fall into three groups. People who use injection drugs who've never been tested, young men who have sex with men, and transgender folk. There's a third element to this, and that is the rollout of our Medicaid healthcare reform platform, a horrible acronym, DSRIP, where in every part of the state, at least one hospital system has been given resources to find people who are either on Medicaid and not using their health insurance or are simply not insured. Through the Affordable Care Act, we have almost comprehensive insurance available here in New York State, and we need to seek out people who aren't insured or are insured but never use their Medicaid, get them hooked up to good primary care that's culturally appropriate, and use that as an opportunity to offer them testing as well as pre-exposure prophylaxis if that's what's appropriate for them.
Can you actually mandate that somebody get tested, though?
It's not a question of mandating that people get tested. It's an issue of being able to articulate to people that this is a normal part of public health.
Getting a vaccine for rubella.
Well, exactly. Or having on your regular physical exam, most people get tested for syphilis just as a matter of course, and that's the way we need to treat HIV testing. It's not saying anything pejorative about the person who's being tested. It's just a standard thing. Women undergo pap smears for HPV and detection of dysplasia. That's not saying anything untoward about their sexual behavior. It's just saying, as a matter of both personal and public health, we standardize the testing so that everyone knows their HIV status and can protect themselves.
So you're trying to sort of destigmatize the whole thing.
Exactly. And I think that's part of the fundamental thing. We need to destigmatize HIV altogether. It's been with us now for over 30 years. We need to normalize the fact that we have somewhere between 120,000 and 150,000 people around the state who are going to be living with HIV for the rest of their lives. And I think that's an important part of the prong. If we can destigmatize it, if we can normalize it, you know, if you have hypertension, the idea of taking medication daily is simply routine for a part of your own health. With HIV, taking your antiretroviral drugs every day is not only should not only be made a routine as a part of your own health, but because it's preventing transmission of disease. Now, the other thing that we know for people who have HIV is that if they have stable, secure housing, they're far more likely to be adherent to their medication. Also, if they have vocational opportunity, if they're in school or working full-time jobs, they're far more likely to be adherent. So it's not just a matter of giving out pills. It's giving people the resources, the tools, providing them with the security that they need in order to maintain adherence to treatment.
Sure. There is another issue here. Some people are bringing up the idea that if you feel too secure, you might become more promiscuous, especially if you provide a pre-exposure prophylaxis. What's your comment?
So, look, sex is a part of human nature. I'm not sure what people mean when they say too promiscuous. When you look at it from a public health perspective, human beings are going to have sex, and unfortunately, various viruses sort of capitalize on that, and that's why we have sexually transmitted disease. That's why we have the transmission of HIV. And so it's not about telling people don't have sex. If you're going to have sex, have it in a way that is safe, that protects you, that protects your sexual partner, is healthy. And I think that's the important message that people need to hear. Public health doesn't make judgments about marital status, about sexual orientation, about gender identity,
right? I mean, this is part of the whole problem with a stigma, is that if you are afraid of some sort of social animosity, you won't get tested.
That's exactly right. And frankly, the same thing. I mean, we've done an amazing job at bringing down new infections among people who inject drugs, but that's because we've normalized things like syringe exchange. And if we can go further, completely decriminalizing syringes in New York State, as is the case in 42 other states, if we can expand our access to syringes in pharmacies and also use those as a location for referral for drug treatment as well as for HIV testing. There are so many things we can do to make New York a healthier place for all of its citizens, irrespective of drug use, what kind of sex people engage in, any of those things. And that's what ending the epidemic is all about, a healthier New York.
I have another quick question, and we have about 1 minute to talk. There are some bills that you're going to be relying on the legislature to pass, like one that prevents discrimination against transgender people.
Exactly.
This has been languishing in the state Senate for several years. What are you hoping they do?
Well, we're actually hoping that putting these bills, and it's not just the bill prohibiting discrimination against transgender folks. We're also proposing that minors be able to consent to HIV treatment and both HPV and HIV prophylaxis by packaging all of these together and showing how they're integrally interwoven in ending the epidemic here in New York State, that we're actually going to start seeing some momentum towards passage.
I want to thank you so much for joining us and explaining what's going on. Charlie King is the CEO of Housing Works, and he was co-chair of Ending the Epidemic Task Force. Thank you again.
Thank you.
This program is presented by WCNY Syracuse. Join us again for the Capital Press Room.